listen to your intuition, listen to your gut, and pipe up if you're feeling like your concerns are not being addressed.
You are listening to The Alzheimer's Podcast with Mike Good of Togetherness, your number one resource for practical tips and insights, empowering you and your family to live well with Alzheimer's. Welcome to episode 74 of the Alzheimer's Podcast, your number one source for practical tips and insights. I'm Mike Good of Togetherness. My goal is always to empower you and your family to maintain a positive experience, reduce and eliminate the need for unnecessary medications, and make your time together with those you care for the best it can be. I'm sure you're always doing your best to provide the best care for your loved one. You want to support them and do the right things, always. But as the disease progresses, you must adjust the level of care you are providing to meet their changing needs. And unfortunately, at some point, you just have to ease up, because too much care can actually be detrimental to quality of life. But how do you know when cheerleading is no longer what is needed? In this episode of Navigating Rough Terrain with the Dementia Sherpa, Christy Turner addresses this sensitive and complex question to help you know when it's time to ease up. Christy, you were just telling me about an article you read today that I'm not even going to try to explain, so I'm just going to let you jump in and explain it to our listeners.
Okay, great. So, first of all, thank you very much for having me on the show. And second of all, this is one of those days where I have a serious bee in my bonnet. I came across this article on Bloomberg today, and I sent you a link, Mike, so maybe we can get that in the show notes so folks can check it out for themselves. But the title of the article is "Nursing Homes Are Pushing the Dying into Pricey Rehab. Elderly residents given intensive therapy in the last weeks of life jumped 65%, a study shows."
Ouch.
And so I immediately, you know, got a little burn going, and just jumping into the article and looking at it, I started thinking about all of the implications for people living with dementia. And for those who might not know, I worked in skilled nursing for a number of years. So I've been on the inside, and I know the pressure to provide rehab for, you know, technically we say it's because we want people to get better. And I do not mean to disparage people who work in long-term care. I think there is that genuine desire. On the financial side, though, the way the system is set up right now, there is very much a financial incentive. And that's what this article is taking a look at.
Oh. So we're talking about people that maybe are like in hospice, or which is generally a 6-month window, or even less than that.
No. So what we'd be looking at for this population that they're discussing in the article would be people who are in a nursing home, which, depending on the state and where somebody lives, has formerly been known as convalescent hospitals, or they're more commonly now called rehab facilities. But this is where someone goes typically after a surgery. So it could be a hip replacement or a hip fracture, knee replacement, that type of thing.
Okay. And just because you have dementia doesn't mean you're not going to go to a nursing home. That level of skill is required for all rehab, right? So you're not going to have that special emphasis necessarily that you need because you have dementia?
Well, let me give you some examples, because This is unfortunately part of the American healthcare system that can get super confusing super quickly.
That sounds good.
So in my own family, for example, I had grandparents who were in an automobile accident, and my grandmother's shoulder was shattered, which is weird because that happened to my mom too, but this is a different side of the family, different situation. So she had to have surgery to have it repaired, and she did. She didn't clear the anesthesia very well, which people over 70, typically it can take up to a year to completely clear anesthesia. And if someone has Alzheimer's, which in her case she did, but we didn't know it yet. After a surgical experience, you can start seeing the dementia symptoms, which is what happened in her case.
Okay.
But she, after surgery, she needed a lot of rehab to be able to, you know, get dressed again and tie her shoes and all of that kind of thing, because you used your shoulder for a lot. So she went to a skilled nursing facility or a rehab facility or a nursing home, whatever you want to call it, that level of care. And she got physical therapy and occupational therapy. She also had dementia, which was becoming increasingly clear. It became a little bit more difficult for her to follow instructions and to follow through with what the therapists were wanting her to do. And so it became apparent during that process, and that's when she was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. So that actually is the situation many folks who get a new dementia diagnosis, it can come via that way. Like maybe the family has had some suspicions, but then something happens where they have an accident or some type of surgery, they end up in rehab, and it's in that process of going through therapy and trying to follow all of these instructions and be compliant with the post-surgical instructions, care instructions, that's where the symptoms really start surfacing and we notice that there's a problem. So certainly this isn't the way that it happens for everyone, but for folks in this situation, this is often where the family finds out that there's also a dementia diagnosis or they're given that formal diagnosis. And you can see for someone with dementia why it would be really difficult to be, or at the very least, extremely challenging to be compliant with what anybody is trying to tell you to do, but especially in a situation where you're not feeling well because you've just had surgery, gone through some type of trauma that required surgery, and now you're being expected to be up and about and follow directions and do these things that don't feel very good. And so tying this back into the article, it's very challenging for people living with dementia to be successful in physical therapy and occupational therapy, which doesn't mean it shouldn't be tried. But looking at it objectively, at a certain point, they're not able to make any more gains. And what the study is showing is that even folks with advanced conditions, advanced disease process, be it dementia or something else, we're still being kind of pushed into therapy. And it was pretty clear it was for financial reasons for the institution rather than for the benefit of the person. And so this got me thinking about all the experiences that I've had and people that I've seen and worked with over the years, and how difficult it is for families to walk that line of, you know, should we be going full bore, rah-rah, cheerleading for work with therapy, keep going, Dad, you're going to get better, it's going to be okay, or how are families supposed to know when to kind of ease back and say, you know, I think we're going to go a different direction here.
Yeah, that must be an extremely overwhelming and difficult position to find oneself in, because you're wanting the best. You want to help them have that good quality of life while they can. You need to be able to trust in the medical professionals and get that little bit of relief and that support from them. But now you have to worry that they're doing it for the wrong motives. And
right.
That's really a shame, and that's too bad to hear.
Yeah. And, you know, families are already in such a tough position trying to navigate all of this because, again, in the U.S., the healthcare system is very fragmented. And unless someone is in an HMO type of insurance where there's a very clear path that is navigated and there are kind of bumper rails along the way, it can be I don't want to say the Wild West. I don't want to be overly dramatic, but it can sure feel that way with trying to figure it all out for yourself. And even within an HMO, there's still an awful lot of new things, new information, new choices, unfamiliar things to navigate through.
In a lot of cases, I think it's also probably hard to get to the proper specialist or a gerontologist or someone that can specialize in dementia, because, you know, they're trying to push you through the system. And now you don't get a doctor, you get a nurse practitioner. And, you know, I can see just all these different complications and the families being so hesitant to second guess. And without having somebody by their side that is advocating for them and their loved one.
Right. And, you know, just a couple of things that you said. Well, number one, I'm a huge fan of nurse practitioner.
Yeah. And I realize I didn't mean any disrespect by that, but it did catch me off guard when I first went in. And, you know, I had a misconception about the term nurse, and then I had to do research and understand more about what they are. So I really didn't mean any disrespect there. I just was kind of trying to emphasize that it's kind of hard to get to the specialist you need sometimes.
Right. And you can end up going into an appointment thinking you're going to see a doctor and it's instead a nurse practitioner. And it's yet another one of those things where you stumble across something completely unexpected and aren't sure.
Exactly.
Is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? What does this mean? But also, like you mentioned, gerontologists, there are blessedly few of them that exist on this planet, right. At least in these United States. There's just a major shortage. And so, you know, and that's typically families that have done some research. They want to see a gerontologist or a geriatrician. And then they realize they're really aren't a ton of them out there. They're pretty close to unicorn status. So trying to navigate through all of that can be very challenging. And I thought it might be helpful if we just talked a little bit about how does a family know when it's time to go full bore therapy, or when it's time to back off of that and go in a different direction where they're really promoting their person just having the best possible quality of life that they can, and recognizing that therapies are not going to necessarily promote that.
I'm looking forward to your strategies or suggestions, if you will, on how they can do that.
So I think that one of the most helpful things that we can do is ask questions. And for longtime listeners of the show, they probably have already gone over to dementiasherpa.com and downloaded the Talking to Professionals guide that has the template that you can use for doctor appointments. But for newer listeners, maybe we can get that in the show notes again so that they can access that. So the template just walks you through an appointment where it cues you to ask questions like, why are you recommending this particular treatment? And what's better about this treatment versus some other treatment? And what type of side effects should we expect? And so this could be medication, this could be therapies, whatever it is. The principle behind that is, I strongly believe in that Stephen Covey, one of the seven habits of highly effective people, which is begin with the end in mind. So if somebody is recommending we do X, Y, and Z, and that involves, let's say, diagnostic testing, one of the great questions to ask, keeping begin with the end in mind at the forefront of your brain, is, okay, so if this test comes back with results we don't like, then what's the next thing that happens? Okay, if that doesn't turn out how we like, then what's the next thing that happens? And along that process of questioning is keeping in mind, would my person be able to physically tolerate this? Would my person understand what's going on, or would they feel like they're being punished? Right. Do they have the, because there's physical, the physical strength of going through therapy, but then there's also the emotional strength. And if a person has dementia and they're at a point in the process where they are losing the ability to self-soothe, that's a really tough ask to have them go through something that's physically demanding when they can't talk themselves through it, when they can't generate that self-talk of, this will be worth it in the end, my life will be better after this, this is just one more repetition and then I'll be done, and you know, things that we sort of take for granted, but for somebody living with dementia, those are very real considerations to keep at the forefront of our mind when we're making these decisions on their behalf about what's going to be best for them and enhance their quality of life to the best of everyone's ability.
Right. It sounds like it would be very beneficial for listeners to, you know, download that questionnaire, that guide, and take notes on it. And when you think of something at home, get your notes on paper and make sure you take that paper in, right? Because these doctor's appointments go so fast these days, it's hard to remember everything. And especially when you're being bombarded with new information during the appointment. So I can see how that would be very beneficial to have that in place and to be thinking about the end in mind, having the end in mind when you do it. And of course, as an engineer, I converted that into a flow chart in my head and said, if this, then do this. If this, then, you know, but
right.
I think that's very, just asking questions and having knowledge is what empowers us to make decisions and have put strategies in place, because without it, we're just flying blind.
It's so true. And I'm really happy to be seeing less and less of this as time has progressed in my career. 17 years ago, when I first got into this line of work, I was working with a generation where typically it was the husband who had dementia, and it was the wife who was the decision maker on his behalf. And the women had been raised during an era where somebody with the title of MD was roughly akin to God.
Right.
And there was no such thing as questioning the doctor. And I see that that has shifted pretty dramatically over these past 17 years, which I'm delighted about. Because the truth of the matter is, anytime humans are involved, there's going to be, you know, we all have our own filter, we make our own judgments, and it's okay to have a conversation. It's encouraged to have a conversation with a healthcare provider to make sure that you understand exactly what the implications are. And too often, and I say this definitely speaking for myself, and it's something that I have made a commitment to working on every time I'm in an interaction with a family, but sometimes they need to lean over the table and thump me on that and say, hey, Christy, we don't quite get what you're saying here.
Right.
Because sometimes professionals can slip into geek speak. Sometimes professionals can make an assumption that you know certain information that you don't know, because you can't know what you don't know, right? You don't even know that's a gap in your knowledge. And I'm working with a family right now that gave me a great reminder of this. The daughter said, okay, well, Christy, how will I know if my mom's newspaper gets delivered to her?
Right, right.
What do you mean? And she said, well, we're going to order a newspaper subscription for her, but the doors in her community are locked at the time that newspapers are typically delivered. So how will I know that she ever got it? Having worked inside a community, I know exactly what the system is, but there's no way she would have known, and I just kind of took it for granted. And that's a mm-hmm. minor example, mm-hmm. relatively speaking, but you can see where it has big implications when we're talking about treatments or medications.
Right.
So,
and I think the vast majority of professionals and, you know, medical professionals are happy when people ask questions. They see it as interest and they want to help. So you know, even when I asked my nurse practitioner the first time, I'm like, what the heck are you? I mean, should I trust you? I'm used to having a doctor. And I forget, I said it, you know, nicely, of course, but he goes,
I hope so.
He goes, you know what? And, you know, you're the only person that's asked me that in over a year. And I'm so happy you did, because I know people don't know, you know. So he, and then we had a good rapport and relationship, but he was, you know, and it eased my concerns and it made him feel better. But I mean, that's just the example I have, but I do think that most medical professionals would love it if you'd ask more questions.
Absolutely. And again, because medical professionals are nothing more than humans with a specialized education.
Exactly.
A lot of times they don't know how to broach certain subjects. And I always think back to when my dad was dying, and it happened very quickly. He died within 36 hours of, like, something doesn't seem right to, you know, within 36 hours he had passed. And when we requested a meeting with the doctor and started asking some questions, it was during that process that it became very clear that the doctor thought we understood where my dad was in this process when we didn't, because nobody had told us. And for me, I was like the person in the family with the most comfort level in a medical situation, the most medical knowledge. But of course, I'm not a doctor. And also, it was highly emotional. So I was no doubt looking at that situation very differently than I would have if I had been there acting on behalf of a client. So it's good for us as family members to ask a lot of questions and to make sure that we understand what they're saying.
Right. All right. So, Christy, we've got our loved one. They're in with the medical professionals. The medical professionals are pushing us down this one path, if or pulling us, whichever, you know, and we're concerned if that's the right path or not. So we're asking questions. What else can we do to know whether it's time to ease up or continue?
Well, one of the things I like to do, and again, longtime listeners are probably like, oh, here she goes again, broken record. But I always say, go with your gut. So if something doesn't feel right to you, doesn't sound right to you, it's just like the hair on the back of your neck is standing up, or you're getting an intuition, whatever you want to call it, listen to that. That is happening for a reason. So, you know, pipe up. You're not going to magically affect a different outcome by being polite. I mean, it's okay to be polite, of course, but I mean, in that suppressing your questions polite kind of way, where you don't want to put anybody out, you don't want to take up too much of anybody's time. Please don't do that. Listen to your intuition, listen to your gut, and pipe up if you're feeling like your concerns are not being addressed, because they need to be, and you are acting on the behalf of your person. And then the second thing, and I say this one all the time too, I just love the FAST scale. So we can no doubt put a link to that in the show notes too, but that helps you understand where your person is in the process. So for example, if your person is, like, let's say at stage 5, which is moderate dementia, meaning they need help selecting the right clothes to wear for the season, right? So they might roll out in a pair of golf shorts and a polo shirt, but it's actually 12 degrees outside. So if you all are planning on leaving the house, then you're going to help them select something more appropriate. So that's where they are. Now, if your person is there in the process and they break their hip, it would seem reasonable to me, knowing nothing else about their overall health, but let's say it's okay, that, yeah, we'd want to surgically repair it and go through the rehab process. Now, if your person is, say, at stage 7B, meaning they have severe dementia and they can only speak one word clearly, and they're completely incontinent and they need assistance with eating, and they're in that last stage of the process, I am probably not going to opt for rehab in that situation.
Christy, I have to show my ignorance here, because when you explain it like that, I am just shocked that rehab's even an option at that point. I am just shocked that there's no medical professionals going, you know what? This isn't going, the outcome of this isn't going to be worth it, and helping those families. And as I'm saying that, I guess I shouldn't be surprised and shocked, but I still am.
Yeah, it goes back to the humans who are involved in the situation. So there are certainly providers who will be very upfront with you. And there are also providers who, you know, if you show any indication, if you as the family member are saying, so surgery and rehab, right? Because that's what you've heard, or you've been through that with another family member. And the provider hears you say that, and they'll go, well, okay, I guess. And might tell a colleague, like, this family, I don't even know why they're asking for rehab, but they're not going to have that conversation with you, because it depends on the human involved and what their perceptions are and their filters and all of that. So that's why I like to use the FAST scale. So it's just very objective. You can look at it, see where your person is in the process, and then ask questions based on that. Okay, well, you just said you're recommending surgery and rehab. I'm looking here on the FAST scale. My person is at a 7B, which means they have the mental age of a one-year-old. Go ahead and tell me how my person is going to be able to go through rehab, and what are their prospects for making it through surgery. Right. So that's how that can really be helpful. The other thing too is family values. So for example, I can think of two people off the top of my head where they had really significant health events that most of the people I've worked with, the family would have chosen, like, okay, this is the end of their life. And in these two situations, the family in those situations had chosen what's called a full code, meaning after someone has ceased breathing and their heart has stopped beating, they chose to have medical professionals do everything technologically possible to bring them back. And that included ventilator and feeding tubes and what have you. And in both cases, it was for religious reasons, religious beliefs, where they felt that heartbeat was what you measure life by, versus other people believe that it's quality of life. So that, you know, there are many factors that come into play. I don't think it's going to come as a shock to anyone that I'm in the quality of life camp, because I talk about it so much. Right. And I have to say, in those other two situations, it was really tough for me to witness someone who had had a massive stroke. No heartbeat, no respirations, heard his ribs cracked as they were trying to resuscitate him. They did resuscitate him. He was bedbound for about another 3 months, skin broke down, all kinds of things happened, but he had a heartbeat. But that was what was important to the family. So there are just so many factors. It's important for families to be clear about what's important to them, and then to be fearless in that moment of, we're going to get the information that we need and we are going to ask questions.
Christy, as we start to wrap up this discussion, I think it's really great that you have these suggestions and to help people know when it's time to ease up. And I think it's really great to, you know, go with your gut to some extent. But I know that people want something to really fall back on, such as that FAST scale. I think that the FAST scale is a great thing for us to go, okay, this is really helping me understand and to follow my gut more, right? Because our knowledge and experiences are what help us know when to follow our gut. And so I think that's really great. And because I know when you make these kind of decisions, you're going, am I making the right decision? You're constantly questioning yourself, right? So to have that FAST scale to fall back on, have another professional, maybe such as you, the Dementia Sherpa, to consult with, maybe even being part of a support group where you can share and get the feedback of others, knowing that you're going to get a wide, might get a wide range of opinions there, but at least you have input to help you balance and come up, make a decision yourself, right? So.
Oh, yeah, I think support groups are fantastic. The only caution I would throw in there is, you know, if you are part of a support group that meets one time a month, you know, the last Friday of the month, and this medical thing is happening on the first or the second Monday of the month, don't wait until, you know, that last Friday of the month. You're going to need to probably be more proactive in most cases.
Okay. So, all right. Well, Christy, I want to thank you again. Did you have any final thoughts or things you want to share before we wrap up today?
I would just encourage our listeners to check out the show notes, where you'll find links to the resources that we mentioned during the show that I think will be really helpful for you.
Absolutely. All right, Christy, we'll talk again next week.
Sounds great. Bye.
This concludes our conversation with Christy Turner, the Dementia Sherpa, right here on the Alzheimer's Podcast, your number one source for practical tips and insights. Be sure to check out the show notes for any mentioned resources or links at togetherinthis.com/episode74. And if you haven't subscribed to the podcast, you can do so there, and that way you won't miss any upcoming episodes. Bye-bye, and I hope you return next week. You've been listening to The Alzheimer's Podcast with Mike Good of Togetherness. For more information and to get the resources mentioned in this episode, visit togetherinthis.com/podcast.